If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Dr. Susan K. Williams is the chief executive of the Royal School of Needlework, and for 17 years has been at the helm of one of the most respected needlework organisations in the world. This is the first part of a very long and very rich needle exchange that I have with Susan, and, well, buckle up everybody, because in this session we talk about small matters like the history of colour in textiles. We talk about how tapestries came from being a utility item, a draft excluder, into an art form. We talk about metal threads in embroidery, and we touch on the Bayeux tapestry and its significance, as well as some other tapestries that you may or may not have heard of. I absolutely love talking with Susan. I had some notes for this episode where I knew that I wanted to talk about just the world of textiles, because she has a perspective on it. She's written books on the history of colour in textiles, and I just didn't want to waste the opportunity to talk to her about this stuff. So this may be a bit of a history lesson, but we are in a context as needleworkers that we enjoy a craft and an art form that has been going around for millennia. And the story of colour is a bit like the story of spice. Global power and international trade from the 15th century and the 16th century. There's such a magnificent history to this stuff that we now really take for granted, thanks to technology and those kind of things. So it's a great conversation. I absolutely loved it. It may be that you'll discover some things you never knew. If it turns out that this makes you think about the colours you're using in your threads a little bit differently, then that's a right result. If you enjoy the show, it'd be fantastic if you could give us a shout out on your favourite social media platforms. Feel free to use the Needle Exchange hashtag. Remember, there's only the one E. I don't know why, just to give myself more explanation time. Seemed like a good idea. But please do share the love if you feel like sharing the love. This is a great episode. You don't get to talk to people like Susan very often, so I'm glad I took the chance. I'll be back next week with the second part of the conversation, where we get in depth about the Royal School of Needlework and what it's like to do work for the King. Oh, yes. But in the meantime, enjoy the show. So we find ourselves with you, Dr. Susan K. Williams, Chief Executive of the Royal School of Needlework. An interesting turning point, would you say?
I think so, yes, because at the end of August, I will retire having completed 17 years at the RSN.
Amazing, amazing. I mean, I noticed that you're not resting on your laurels, though. Shout out to the Society of Dyers and Colourists, who probably were like, oh, we'll have you. Thanks very much.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I've just become president of the Society of Dyers and Colourists because my research interest is in the history of dyes and colours, and particularly colours in textiles. And I wrote on that previously, and I'm hoping that with my retirement, I'll have time to get back to researching that again, because there's so much to do. I really want to focus on the 19th century, and Jamie is holding up a copy of the book.
I love this book, and I mean, you've signed it for me. That was marvellous. But like, it was one of the things I wanted to do. I've got a note here that says, "Can we offer a potted history of the colour, history of colour in textiles?" And I think that could cover us for the next hour. And it is something I want to talk about because, to me, it's one of these things that we so take for granted now. We so take for granted, and then you read your book, and it's a bit like the spice trade, isn't it? It's one of these stories of, like, global power. Can you try and give us a potted history of colour in textiles?
Yeah, that is normally starting with at least a one-hour lecture. But
yeah. Let's go 20 minutes, see what happens.
In the short version, I think it's what I'd like to say is that we should better recognise people before things were written down were investigating, and they took every plant and every species and said, what use is this? Mm. And that's what led them to discovering the colours. And it's hard to know which came first, the desire to have more colour or the experimentation. But either way, they started with the experimenting. And I mean, let's just take rhubarb as one plant. So the roots of rhubarb are actually a dye stuff. They will give you a yellow dye.
Okay.
Then the stalk of rhubarb, well, for many centuries, that was thought of as medicinal, but that's edible. And then you've got the leaf of rhubarb, which is poisonous. So pity the person who first tested it in a sense of tasting it, because they might have been very ill. but actually, the leaf can give you a mordant, so a fixative, to help fix the colour that's in the roots. So it's all kind of intertwined, and our early forebears did this work. And I mean, there's a settlement in a place called Mohenjo-Daro, which is in the Indus Valley, and that dates back to about 2400 BC.
Right.
And they found, because it's quite a dry area, they found some fragments of textile. And when they did some analysis on them, they realised that they'd already worked out that they didn't just need to dye with a colour, they needed a mordant to help the colour be fixed in place. And so all of this is through experimentation. And when over the, as the Silk Route was developing and people started to travel, what they came across was that people had worked out how to get blue out of the indigo plant, which again is not a simple process. It's a very complicated process, but they discovered it in many individual places. And then as the merchants started traveling along the Silk Road, they could pass on, oh, well, there's a tip here from the last lot. Mm-hmm. They're doing this and that can make it better. And so that's kind of that exchange of information then started through the Silk Road. But colour does go back an awfully long way in the experimentation. And the methodology of making colour for textiles actually didn't change very much from those first inquiries at that research area. When they'd worked out how to do it, that kind of stayed in place, only slightly bigger scale, not huge scale, up until the 19th century. So it was still using the kind of vessels that one person could stand at to work, whether it's on skeins of wool or hanks of wool, whatever, in the fleece or pieces of fabric. If it's pieces of fabric, you need two people because they're heavier. This was, again, one of those trades that became more and more popular by the 19th century. It needed to be industrialised. But it was a world trade long before the 19th century, with colours and the dye stuffs coming from all over the world. So woad was the blue that we had in Europe. But when indigo started being brought over at the end of the 16th century, that gives you a much darker blue. So that was preferred. albeit France and Germany tried to put prohibition on its use because they had major woad industries and they didn't want them being wiped out.
Interesting.
And then the cochineal beetle, for example, comes from Mexico and Peru. So it was brought across by the Spanish when they discovered it. And it became the second most valuable export from the New World after silver. So this gives you a sense of the value of it. And there were pirates on the sea who would try and interrupt the ships that were coming from the New World to take the cochineal. And cochineal was then compared with kermes, which is the European bug, if you like, the European insect that gives red. And it was found that even with all that distance and therefore money, cochineal gave a better bang for the buck. You know, there was more red in cochineal beetles than in kermes insects. So cochineal became the very strong red colour alongside madder, which is the plant red, which has been around for a long time. So these colours were really strong international trade. And that continued. So you know, even into the 19th century, colours coming from India, but then going back to India. So I was in India a few years ago and found in one of the museums talking about colour adverts for 19th century German dye companies in India, just to show that the colours had started going the other direction as they moved to the synthetics.
It's incredible. It's such an incredible story, isn't it? Because as you say, like, it starts off with experimentation. One thing that always strikes me is the difference between what happens when you put salt in bread, in flour to make bread, you know, and that somebody worked that out. One day somebody did it and went, oh my God, that's really nice. And that's just like one example, isn't it? We take this stuff so much for granted.
We do. And because we've kind of lost an aspect of the experimentation. We expect everything to be ready and sorted. And we need to kind of get back to that a little bit to understand that if you don't know what everything is for, you're going to want to experiment more and say, what other use could we make of this? I mean, for example, guano. So guano, bird droppings. There are islands off the coast of Peru that were, again, discovered, became aware of in the 19th century. They harvested the guano because these small islands are just covered with bird droppings over the surface, and they would go and collect that, and it was literally shipped back to Europe, and then they experimented and they realized that it could be a dye stuff, and the yellow that they got from it was called picric acid, but this became a late 18th early 19th century dye stuff. And that you can still go to those islands, or at least off the coast of those islands off the side of Peru today, and you ostensibly go to see the seal colony that is at the foot of those islands, but on the top of the islands you can still see it is covered in white, and even today it is still harvested about every 5 years, not for the yellow color, not for making into picric acid, but for a fertilizer. So you know, it's still being used.
They're just sitting there stroking their chin going, there's a lot of bird poo. There's got to be something we can do with it, right? Like, how
yes.
Is there a sense then from what you've said, because I love the fact as well that you get these, you know, indigo being used in different places, I guess because people are looking at what's around them and making best use of that. And then I suppose from what you've said, there's a certain acceleration that comes because people start to make money. And then they'll go, I'm going to spend my money on research and development, albeit the 18th century version of that.
Yes, textiles have long been a significant industry. I mean, back to the medieval period, in this country, the big product was wool. So we were famous for wool, and we exported our wool. We were slightly less famous for our cloth. You know, our cloth wasn't always of the best quality. Other places could make it better. So we exported it as wool and then re-imported it back as cloth. But then we got better at making different cloths and so on. So the textile industry has made fortunes for many people, and not just in Britain. I mean, in earlier centuries, for the Romans as well, the textile industry was a major industry. So it's long been a source of income for people. And then inevitably, some people make more out of it. But hopefully some people would also then do the research. I mean, the whole way in which synthetic colour was discovered was actually by an 18-year-old student of the Royal College of Chemistry. And this was back in the mid-19th century. Royal College of Chemistry was then on Oxford Street in central London.
Okay.
He was a very keen student. He was actually on his Easter holiday, and he went home to his home laboratory, and he had been tasked to try and find synthetic quinine, because quinine was the great prophylactic against malaria. And we were beginning to run out of natural quinine, and it was clearly going to be needed for longer, so could they make synthetic quinine? When he realised from his experiment he hadn't found synthetic quinine, he didn't stop, or he didn't throw it away. He took that same old question and said, yes, but what use is this? Mm. And he added some water to his compound, and then he put in some cloth, and the cloth took the colour from the pot, and he had discovered the first synthetic colour made from the leftovers of coal tar byproducts. And William Perkin, you know, really changed the development of colour overnight. And that then became the new science. It became really exciting. And I compare it to try and give people an understanding. I compare it to when people were looking for the COVID vaccine. How many different groups all over the world were suddenly rushing to try and find the COVID vaccine. And, you know, okay, there was a sort of time imperative in that there was a pandemic, but there was also the science imperative. What can we find as the way to solve this? How can we overcome this? And it's that science aspect which drove many people in the mid-19th century to start looking at synthetic dyes and saying, this is new science. Let's see what we can do. And it's why so many different people got involved in it. And in England, we've always taken the view of being kind of experimenting on the job, whereas in Germany, they go back to the lab bench and they do experimenting in a major way at the lab bench. And that was why, by the end of the 19th century, the Germans had become the major centre of research into the synthetic dyes, and England slightly lagged behind, because it was all about experimenting at the workplace. But it was all that new science. And then people kept on experimenting right the way through to, you know, Perkin was 1856, through to 1956, and ICI came up with Procyon dyes. And Procyon dyes was another major leap forward, because normally you talk about the dye stuff penetrating the fibres of the thread. And the more they penetrate the fibres, the stronger the colour will be. With indigo, of course, it doesn't penetrate the fibres. It clings to the outside, which is why when you're wearing your jeans and you rub your hands down your jeans, the colour is disappearing, because you're literally rubbing it off. But with Procyon dyes, that actually has a chemical reaction with the fibre. So it makes the dye stuff even stronger, and that means it should last longer through things like washing and sunlight exposure and all of those different things. So that was, you know, in some cases, was the last really big development of dye stuffs.
And those kind of colours that they're creating at that point, are they the kind of colours that would then get imbued into, I don't know, plastics or anything that colours anything? Is that the same fundamental science?
It is that they would look, although for each different type of product, if I can call it that, there might be different types of ways that you use the color. So for example, for a painter, you're using a pigment, something that will mix with the color and help you to lay it down on a painting. For something for plastics, it's got to be something that's going to be absorbed by the plastic, whatever the type of plastic it is, and how that works. So it might not be exactly the same as the chemical compound that you would use for a textile. Because right. I remember back in 20, must have been past 2011, and I was on the London committee of the Society of Dyers and Colourists, and one of our members came in and she went, oh, what a day. That they had been trying to match the colour that had been set down by the designer for the uniforms that were going to be worn by the officials at the Olympics who were going to be inside the athletics ring, you know, so the ones that are in that green bit in the middle, all those people who'd be measuring the shot put and all of that. And the colour had probably been done on Pantone, which is not an exact colour for textiles.
Right.
And then you've got the material that is being supplied. And if that material, particularly if it's a mixture of a natural fibre and a synthetic fibre, the way it takes colour, it might be very challenging, because wool and silk take colour very easily. Cotton and linen is more difficult for them to take the colour. And if you have a synthetic, they will have similar properties. Some will be like wool and silk and some will be like cotton. So if you have, let's say, cotton with a synthetic that's wool and silk, then half of that fabric or different parts of the fabric might be taking colour in different ways. And that makes it very complicated. So actually getting an even dye across a mixed fabric is still a really big challenge.
So when they go, oh, so we're going to do this lovely velour panel on the back of like a polyester top, you just sit there with your head in your hands and you're thinking, oh my God. Yeah.
Fortunately, not me. There are other people who spend their days doing exactly that.
That's amazing. Because the other thing that struck me, I think, when I was reading your book was how people would make art using paint, and they would paint a picture of, I don't know, a scenery. And then people would go, I'd really like a tapestry version of that. But it wouldn't necessarily be possible because the technology didn't exist to be able to recreate the same colours.
That's right. I mean, if you think back to the Raphael cartoons, which are in the V&A, and these were designed for Pope Leo X at the beginning of the 16th century, so about 1515. And he commissioned Raphael to come up with some designs that would go round the lower part of the Sistine Chapel. So this is just after Michelangelo has finished the ceiling. The church, in terms of decoration, has always believed more is more. So he wanted something to go round the walls. And he commissioned Raphael to do a series of designs based on the Acts of the Apostles. And he then... Raphael knew that these were cartoons, really, that they were going to be used for tapestry weaving. But he could use many different colours, and he had the advantage of lead white and lead yellow, which would help to modify all the very strong colours. So you can get a much more, you know, what we would recognise today as a much more even painting. Mm-hmm. But then he had to pass that over to the dyers and weavers. And the colours that were available to the weavers were far fewer. And so there were major changes. For example, in paintings, St. Peter is always portrayed in a golden cloak. There wasn't a good gold in dyes at that time. And so they then put St. Peter in a red cloak because that was the strong, the power colour. And you could also get some a bit more shading in the red because it was a very strong colour in the first bath. And then, but interestingly, in one of the interpretations, one of the panels, it's got a figure of Christ, and Christ has a white garment, except in the tapestry that has then had stars, golden stars added to it. And the reason for that is that the stars can have a bit of movement in them. And right. Therefore you get the visual illusion that this is not just a flat rectangle of fabric or anything, but that it actually is a draped outfit that has folds and flow and movement to it. So that it was really important to do something different because of the limitation of the colours. And to make it worse, they didn't really have very good flesh colours. And they didn't have many. You know, today we have multiple shades of white. Well, standing behind Christ in this tapestry are sheep. So something else that's kind of white. So they needed to be able to differentiate between Christ, the sheep, and you know, and the clothing he was wearing. So hence them putting stars onto the garment.
And they hadn't invented French knots, which is often, I think, a turn to when people are making sheep. Is that right?
Yes. Well, French knots don't quite work in a tapestry. So this was for a woven tapestry, and the methodology has to be laying it down. You lay it down flat. I mean, tapestries are other wonderful things. And I, again, do lectures on tapestries because most people have no idea how a tapestry is made. And in many cases, they are made working from the back, not the front. So you have to look through the warp threads to see what the final thing is looking like. And then even more complicated, and particularly unlike a painting, where even with the cartoons, Raphael could have the whole cartoon out at once and he can see what he's doing and it's the right way up. On a tapestry, it's woven through 90 degrees. And the reason for that is because you are making the fabric at the same time as you are making the picture, you want the fabric to be as strong as possible. And if you've got clothing that kind of is draped like this, like up and down movements, I'm remembering it's we're on audio, yes, with up and down movements, you don't want lots of different threads changing when they're not fastened together. So if you turn it through 90 degrees, you can then have your individual shades, one on top of the next, and then it makes it a much tighter fabric. And then when you turn it back through the 90 degrees, you can see what's known as hatching. You can see the shading in the individual lines.
And by the way, this is the 16th century. We're still talking like candlelight, hand manoeuvres. My goodness.
Yes.
Is that another one of those classic things that people do just take for granted, because you only really see those kind of scale pieces in stately homes. Those kind of things are up on the walls. You don't get a good bit of a... What are the other things that people never realise about tapestries?
I think just the way in which they are, say, worked from the back, and the fact that...
I'm sorry to interrupt. Why are they worked from the back then? What's the...
Well, if you think about it, the front is what people are going to see, and the threads that you're working with, you're taking from the back, so that you're doing the fastening off, and the when you kind of... You don't knot, but you fasten the threads round at the back so that, again, to try and keep it as coherent as possible and as strong as possible so they're not going to unravel, as it were. So that's why you're working it from the back.
Is there generally a rule where they just go, we're going to be massive? I remember someone once doing a joke where they said you could tell, like Mozart, maybe, when he decided to write a concerto, he went, I'm just going to make this really difficult, like straight out of the bat, you know. And you think with tapestry, do they just go, right, this has to be 15 foot wide, I'm afraid. No smaller, you know?
Yes, well, the purpose of tapestries in the when they were first brought out in the sort of 15th century was... Actually, as to help with room warmth, because the people who could afford them had the big castles, the big baronial halls. So think particularly, you know, Duke of Burgundy, for example, had a huge collection of tapestries. And the advantage of tapestries was that you could hang them inside the walls of your baronial hall, and they would literally act as draft excluders. So they had a practical purpose. And then, because they could be hung, they could also be taken down. So the way that the great and the good lived in those days is that they had a castle, they stayed there until it got particularly filthy, and then they moved on to the next one. So they wanted things that they could take down, roll up, put onto the back of a cart, and get moved to the next hall, and then they would be all set out again. And so that was a key part of it. But tapestries were expensive. They took a long time to make, years for some of them to be made. And they would work, usually would work from the smaller side, because that's the turning through 90 degrees. So if you think about the drop and the width. But yes, they were indeed large. And the other big thing is, as they make them, they're rolled up. So you have to have made sure that you have dyed enough wool all at the same time at the beginning. Mm. And not start trying to dye colours later, because you can't match to something you now can't see because it's rolled up. And the fact that you, as weavers, you will not see the finished thing until it's completely finished, and then you can unwrap it and you finally look at the whole. That you don't see the whole. You know, it's not like Raphael being able to stand back from the cartoon and go, oh, a bit more light there, a bit more shade here. You couldn't do that. Everything has to be done as you work it sequentially.
That's a major project management headache, I would argue.
Yes. Absolutely.
So, I mean, but these would have been like professional tapestry. I mean, were the great tapestry makers?
Well, they were in, first of all, they were in Brussels and around there. Then they moved to France. In fact, there's a line in Hamlet which says he's hiding behind the arras. And the arras is the tapestry. Arras was one of the places where tapestry was made. And there were some major makers. So Peter van Aelst was one of the major makers, and he was the one who did his studio did the Raphael cartoons for the Pope. So yeah, there were some known makers of tapestry, and they would be the ones who oversaw all of this work. And again, making a series of tapestries, because that was common. Tapestries were big. And they were narrative, and there were a series of them, again, to go around the room.
And so here's another, two thoughts then. Because when you say they were in France and Belgium, is that because they had the best access to the right kind of materials to achieve those goals? Was there still that geographic placement as to why those became the centres for those things?
Good question. I think it was definitely access to the materials, and there was also a sort of centre for dyeing in Bruges. That was a major centre for dyeing materials. But also they would have access to the wool coming over from Britain, which could then be spun to whatever they wanted for the fine wools for the tapestry making. And then, of course, they'd also add in, sometimes they would add in silk for things like faces, and sometimes they would add in metal threads. So again, in the Vatican tapestries, there are metal threads wound into there. Now, after 500 years, you don't really notice the metal threads because they will have tarnished somewhat. But they were first put on show by Pope Leo X, sort of just after Christmas, 1519, and that would have been candlelight. Imagine what they would have looked like with metal threads in them in candlelight, and you'd see the metal threads glistening as part of it. So it would have looked really splendid. But It was very traditional to include metal threads in the most expensive pieces. We've also got them in the Abraham tapestries, which are at Hampton Court Palace. These are the most valuable tapestries in the United Kingdom. Wow. And the reason that we still have them, they were commissioned by Henry VIII, and shortly after the Raphael tapestries. And we still have them because during the Civil War in the 17th century, many tapestries were destroyed to be melted down to claim back the metal thread that was them for the war effort. First by the army of Charles I, and then subsequently by the parliamentarians. But the Abraham tapestries were saved because Cromwell liked them. Cromwell right. actually had them around in his rooms that he had at Hampton Court Palace. So that was why they were saved. But they did an inventory of everything that they found at Hampton Court. And even then, the tapestries were valued more highly than the Triumph of Caesar Mantegna paintings that are also at Hampton Court Palace. So the value of the tapestries was more.
And the fact that you were able to put metal threads into them, like, I mean, again, that's some technology for 500 years ago, right? That can't have been an easy thing to achieve.
Metal threads go back even longer than that because...
Really?
Yes. they're one of the oldest threads, if you like.
Right.
The oldest fully, well, it's not fully complete, but the major piece in this country is St. Cuthbert's Stole. This is at Durham Cathedral in their museum. And it was... we even know when it was commissioned. It was commissioned in the 10th century, originally given to the Bishop of Winchester by Eofled, who was the mother-in-law of King Athelstan. And then later King Athelstan had these pieces put into the tomb of St. Cuthbert, and that is what protected them. Having said that, the sort of textile part of it, when the tomb was opened in the 19th century, the textile part had mostly disappeared, but what hadn't was the metal thread part. And that was still not only in good order, but because it had been laid out, was pretty much whole. And so right. now there are big conservation stitches kind of holding the thing together, but it was because they were metal threads that it had endured. And a metal thread was used extensively for Opus Anglicanum, which is often right. considered the high point of English embroidery in the 13th to 15th centuries. And again, they used, mostly it was filet, which is where you've got a thread in the centre, so silk thread in the centre, and then a very fine layer of the gold that is wrapped round, you know, thinner than a piece of paper, is wrapped round the thread. But there's also wire, so gold and silver wire that you draw out and you put it through an aperture. And each time it's drawn, it gets slightly thinner, but slightly longer. You don't lose any metal from it, but so you get it longer but thinner until you take it down until it can actually be used to be worked into weavings and textiles. Or you get pearl, which is like a little tiny coil, and that can be in all sorts of lengths, but you can chop that up and you can use it almost like a bead, or you can use it as an edging material. And then there's flat metal thread, which can also be used. So there are lots of different metal threads. And as I say, these were being used extensively in the early medieval period.
But you can, as you said, the candlelit like presentation of a tapestry that sparkles in the light, I bet there were gasps heard across Europe off of the back of that thing or something.
Yes, indeed. It would have been quite an event to have been invited to see them. Mm.
another question that sprung to mind then is, therefore, and this is ignorance on my part, happy to say that, is therefore the Bayeux Tapestry a tapestry or not a tapestry?
It is an embroidery. Now, yes. I have three theories as to why the Bayeux Tapestry is called a tapestry. And number one is that the French word for embroidery is tapisserie. It does not take a huge jump to get from tapisserie to tapestry. Yep. So we very much, the people who've researched it very much believe it was made in England. But for Bishop Odo, a brother of William the Conqueror, and for Bayeux Cathedral, because someone has been measuring out parts of Bayeux Cathedral to say the length of the different sections would go around here. So that's why it kind of got into the French name. But then the other two factors as to why it might have got stuck with the name tapestry is because it's very large and it's narrative, which are the same two factors for the proper woven tapestries that are made.
Right.
But the Bayeux Tapestry, I have to say, I finally got to see it recently, and I've been trying for many years to get to see it. Absolutely fascinating, although they do try and walk you round very quickly by constantly telling you what's in the next panel, and I just ignored them and let people just waved people past me so I could look at it in more detail. But it is on a linen background, and so again it's an embroidery because you start with a ground fabric, which is what differentiates an embroidery from woven tapestry, where with woven tapestry you only begin with the warp threads and then you work the weft threads through it. So you have a ground fabric for embroidery, and that means you don't have to cover the entirety, you know, unless a canvas, when you probably would cover the majority of the area you're going to see. But for other embroideries, you don't have to cover all the background fabric. And then with the Bayeux Tapestry, it's mostly laid work. It's known as Bayeux stitch, so that you've got stitches going in one direction, and then you'll have securing stitches, but set apart, but going in the other direction. So this can make costumes, whether it's the horses, whether it's the other, you know, various different features that they've got in the Bayeux Tapestry. But it means that it's a very effective way of using the thread. So your very strongly coloured threads, you're perhaps only securing at the top and the bottom. And then you'll use some lighter threads going through the middle to hold the whole thing in place. So the back is nowhere near as heavy or dense in thread as the front. So it's a sort of economic way of using the threads. But can look really, really quite striking. And what I was surprised at, because it doesn't come across in many of the photographs, was the textural quality of the work. Because it's the laid work, it does kind of give a surface dimension, a surface texture to it that, as I say, I hadn't seen in many of the pictures. So that was great to look at.
And was it commissioned? Was it an 11th century piece? Was that when it was made?
Yes, it was made at the end of the 11th century, about the 1090s.
So again, we're talking like limited colour palette, all of those kind of challenges as well.
Yes, so there are only 10 colours used in the Bayeux Tapestry. But the way that they've done it, and again, some of the combining, it gives you a sense of it being more. But the people who've researched it have said it's 10 colours.
Right. Because then you've got, since then, I'm thinking, I've seen the Quaker Tapestry, which is in... where is that? The Lake District.
It is, yes.
I've seen the Great Tapestry of Scotland. Mm-hmm. I feel like we're now going to go, not a tapestry.
They're all embroideries.
Yeah,
they're all
this is the thing, isn't it?
It is that sense of that people have kind of taken up that concept from the Bayeux. The one that is different is, of course, the Overlord embroidery, which is the embroidery that the RSN made in the late 1960s, early 1970s to replicate, commemorate D-Day. So the embroidery itself, which is now on permanent display near Portsmouth, that has always been known as an embroidery. And it's a mixture of applique and surface stitch in 34 different scenes that tell the story of D-Day.
Okay, amazing. I didn't know about that one. The other one that I do, I said, I think when I did Isabella Rosner's podcast, I was on hers and she asked me about my favourite needlework. And one of the ones I chose was the Game of Thrones tapestry, not a tapestry, but also like that's the longest one in the world now, I think, isn't it?
Yes, I don't know about the length.
No. It's very like strong narrative. I think it's 80 panels or something like that. As an aside as well, on Radio 2's Steve Wright radio show, they used to do factoids. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that a factoid is an incorrect fact that becomes commonly recognised to be true, such as these are tapestries when they're embroideries. And I remember once emailing Steve Wright's show to go, the fact that you've used the word factoid, which they would have as like little true facts, is in and of itself a factoid, but nobody ever really got back to me about that. I digress. Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's needle.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.